welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
For some of them, it's been days of journey. And the dust from the surrounding valleys and hills just show the crowd that's still making their way in. Some had got the news the time was going to be short. There's not much time left. They packed up what possessions they needed and they set off. For others, it's been standing by and watching, waiting to hear word. It was just 2 weeks ago, we were at a memorial for Sarah. We saw her burying. We had this great challenge about living a legacy, a life that counts. And yet in real time now, it's been 38 years since she's been put in the tomb that Abraham bought for her. And today they gather once again. Now the family spread, not just numerically, but geographically. Now they show up and there's introductions. I'm Dathan, I'm Hanar's kid from the tribe of Uriah. And then there's introduction, son, this is your cousin, or this is an uncle, or this is a great. And when you get to family reunions that are like that, and the family has been split and split over time in a blended family, you're not even quite sure what the titles are. You just know your family. And this time it's the old man with the beard that's laying down in front. He's 175 years old. This is the end of chapters that we've been looking at. This is the end of one legacy and the passing the torch to the next. It's one of the greatest, one of the largest memorial services of all time. And in this scene, we're going to find not one, not two, but three generations. Three generations in one chapter that all seem to pass on some incredible traits and yet weaknesses. And in this scene, I'm going to challenge you today with maybe one of the hardest things I've ever challenged you with today. And I understand that. Whether you're in Carlsbad and Fallbrook and Green Oak and Kailua, whether you're watching in one of the many groups around the nation or internationally, if you're here on the Vista campus, I'm going to challenge you to do something today that I think to date has been one of the hardest things I'm ever going to ask you to do. And I get that. Unapologetically, I get that. But we're going to look at one chapter and I'm going to ask you simply to stop it. For your own benefit, stop it. And I know it's going to take courage and guts. And to jump into what that is, I want you to turn to Genesis 25, first book in the Bible. We have the passing of the torch, if you will. We've been watching this for now over 13 chapters of God calling a man Abraham, saying, out of you, I'm going to make a great nation. A guy that didn't deserve it, a guy that didn't earn it, a guy that came from an idol-worshipping family in the backwoods of Babylon. And God said, I'm going to pick a nation, a person to start a country. And out of that, I'm going to bring my son, salvation for the world. It'll be called Israel, the Jewish people. And it starts with one man, of course, a non-Jew. There were no Jews at that time. And he and his wife, Sarah. And we've been watching this journey for 13 chapters. Where about 70% of the world's religions, even today, go back and claim the beginning, the origin of their belief, their philosophy, their religion to this man and his descendants. And in chapter 25, we find the end of his story. Now, Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. Jokshan was the father of Sheba and Dedan. The descendants of Dedan were the Asherites, the Letushites, and the Lemanites. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Abida, Eldad. All these were descendants of Keturah. And that's why I say there's introductions. They can't pronounce the names, let alone remember them, but you've got generations that have spread. I have no idea how to pronounce these names. You read them fast with authority. People think he must have gone to school. And you don't know. They're dead. They'll never correct us. It's a whole bunch of names. Everyone gathers back together. Abraham's passed on. After Sarah, after the debacle, and there's not enough time to catch you up if you're just joining us, but some chapters ago, Abraham and Sarah promised to be a great nation, got into being 90 and Abraham 100, and realized we're not having kids. So Abraham decided to sleep with a maidservant, had a son through her named Ishmael. Then later God did give him a son, Isaac. And we think, well, that's the sons of Abraham. Well, after Sarah passed on, in the age of 130, Abraham remarried and had many more sons. Go, Abe. Long before any little blue pill was invented. This dude at 130 said, I still got some years left in me. And he's got generations of kids that come along. Sometimes we forget that. There's tape on the ground. ADD boy sees shiny. Has to pick it up, throw it to the side. Now we're back and going. Verse 5. Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac. The whole time I'm looking at it going, does anybody see the tape on the ground? I can't teach. Abraham left everything he owned to Isaac, but while he was still living, he gave gifts to the sons of his concubines and sent them away from his son Isaac to the land of the east. Abraham loved these other boys. He did give them some of his possessions. I mean, remember, this is an incredibly wealthy guy. His livestock, his business, if you will, filled the land. So he was taking off sheep and cattle and donkeys and herds and giving them son after son after son. But you guys go east. This land is given to my son Isaac. This land, this nation is promised through one heir, and that is going to be Isaac. I love you boys. You each have part of inheritance. Little chunks, take it and go. But the home here, the promise here, that's for my boy Isaac. Now, on Saturday night, someone wrote a card. You skipped over concubines. Why'd you do that? Because I don't have enough time to chase everything in this text. And let me just say, yeah, it seems like in the Old Testament, a lot of dudes took multiple wives. It was never required from God. It was never honored from God. And every time they did that, it got into multiple problems. But it happened. I don't know how to explain it other than that. New Testament's very clear. Every husband, one wife. Every wife, one husband. That's the way it works. But in the olden days, they had more. And with more spouses come a lot more problems. And that's why we read about it. So here we go. Altogether, Abraham lived 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man, full of years. He was gathered to his people. His sons Isaac, circle, highlight, underline, and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, near Mamre, in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite. The field, remember a few chapters ago, that Abraham had bought for the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with his wife Sarah. After Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac, who then lived near Beer Lahai Roy. Isaac stayed where God met people. Isaac stayed in the land that God had promised. Abraham dies at 175 years. Isaac, all the other sons, all the other generations, gather to say goodbye. And in through the sight of the crowd, there's a hush and murmuring. Crowd splits as Ishmael walks up and takes his seat on the front row. I know we've been going week by week. It doesn't seem that long ago. But when you look at it, no matter how you decide to do the math, according to the word, it's been about 60 years since we last saw Ish. About 60 years ago, when Abraham and Sarah realized we have our boy, the one God promised Isaac. Unfortunately, I have another son by another woman, Ishmael, who I also love. And the double wide trailer isn't big enough for both families. And Abraham had to send Ishmael and Hagar away. And God said, I'll take care of them. You're not killing them. You're not abandoning them. I'll take care of them. But your house isn't big enough for this blended family like this. You can't keep two women and two sons. The animosity, the hatred that came out at a birthday party is all through the text. And in the midst of this incredible memorial scene, where we have generations, Ishmael and his clan come riding in. There's got to be a few nervous glances. There's a hush on the crowd. That's the other one. That's the one we've talked about. And Ishmael has to travel through his father's land and once again be reminded of what he must think is his. I'm the firstborn. I don't care how I got here. This should be mine. This is my inheritance. And he takes his seat on the front row next to Isaac and his family. And the Bible's pretty clear. There's not a lot of hugs. No one extends a handshake. There's no huge embraces and apologies. In fact, it closes off the line of Ishmael with just a couple verses. In 12, this is the account of Abraham's other son Ishmael, whom Sarah's maidservant, Hagar the Egyptian, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the son of Ishmael, listed in order of their birth. And now we'll just do first letters. In the firstborn of I and K and A and M and M and D and M and H and T and J and N and K. These are the sons of Ishmael. And these are the names of the 12 tribal rulers according to their settlements and camps. Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. Did you catch that? when Ishmael dies at 137 years, he's gathered to his people. It's not what's mentioned there. It's who's not mentioned there. When Ishmael dies, Isaac doesn't show up. When Ishmael dies, Isaac doesn't bring his family to his brother's memorial. When Ishmael dies, it's a good riddance. Good riddance, goodbye, good luck, good life. And there's one sentence that captures the entire scene. His descendants settled in the area from Havilah to Shur near the border of Egypt as you go toward Asher, and they lived in hostility toward all of their brothers. Way to go, Dad. Blew that one. You blew that one. You had a woman, you decided to take another woman, now you got multiple kids. Now from the very beginning, there's animosity. From the very beginning, you had to choose a side. From the very beginning, you had to leave one. From the very beginning, there's hatred. And some 60 years later, all the way to the end of a memorial service, they're fighting. From all the way to the end of life, one brother dies thinking, that should have been mine, and there's bitterness. And another brother simply says, good riddance. The earth is better if you're not here. And it all comes back to Dad's choice. And I realize as we read the opening of 25, as we're about to read now the second half of 25, this pattern of fighting, bitterness amongst God's family and peoples is going to continue, not for one, not for two, but for three generations, and then it's going to go beyond. And in reading this chapter, with so many ways we could go from it, that's where I wanted to hit today. Man, my bet is, in a room this size, with all of our venues and all of our campuses, wherever you're watching, my bet is there are so many of you in here today that are still feeling the effect of a father figure in your life, or lack of. Because every boy is innately created to be loved by dad. Every boy grows up wondering, do I have what it takes? Am I man enough? Am I masculine? And the only way a boy finds masculinity is when dad bestows masculinity on him. It's why my 7-year-old still, every day of his life, wakes up dreaming of how to take me down. I love that. When he was little, he was just dumb enough to run straight at me, and I'd pick him up and throw him to the left, to the right, and he'd just keep coming and coming and coming. Now as he's older and much wiser in the strategy of warfare, he looks for the opportunities where dad's clueless. Where I'm standing in the backyard at the barbecue grill trying to get dinner ready, and all of a sudden I hear this, and I'm like, is there something flying overhead? But you only have a half second to hear the sound. Before right below the short line, right on the bare skin, the plastic bat comes in. Thwack! And you're like, oh! And I turn just in time to see the bat drop and him running for his life. He has got to make it to mom before I make it to him. And over his shoulder, he is squealing with delight, hands raised triumphantly. He made the giant howl. And every little boy is born with an innate desire to know, do I have what it takes? He comes out wrestling. He comes out grappling with dad. And when that figure is removed, boy is left wondering where masculinity is. And we try to find it in the most insane of places. In our athleticism, in our dating life, in our sexual conquest, in our business, in our prosperity. Do I have what it takes? Because there's a gap when dad's not there. Every little girl is created with an innate desire to find her beauty from dad. Oh, thank God they look like mom. But inwardly, they're craving to know, am I beautiful? Am I value? Do I have worth? And they find that from masculinity, from dad raising them and letting them know, you are beautiful. And I'm not talking about appearance. It's who you are. And when that is not there, every little girl will grow up and try to find it from masculinity to masculinity to masculinity. And some of the most heartbreaking of ways and places. And early on, dad had to leave the scene. Early on, dad made a choice. Early on, dad said, I'm sorry I brought you into this world, but I'm going this way and you're going that way. And Genesis 25 is ripped with it. The boys will come back. They'll sit in the front row at the memorial service, only to part ways and never speak again. Only for their families to constantly war it out. To the headlines of today, we still have the Jewish and the Arab world fighting over where Abraham lived. That dome, that rock, that place, that tomb. And we have it today. And some of you are sitting here as grown adults, decades later, and you've still got that bitterness, that gap, that wound, and it comes from father figure, and Satan delights in that. Because all throughout Scripture, the picture we are given of God is Father, Holy Father, a loving Dad. When Jesus taught us how to pray, He said, "Our Father who art in heaven." And when some of us hear that word, it's the F word of Christianity. We cringe. Thanks, but no thanks. I had a father. I'm not about to sign up for that again. And that's why there's such an onslaught on the father figure in the homes in our country today, I believe. And it starts in chapter 25. Ishmael will show up and bury the old man. In 60 years of regret, he'll help shovel dirt into the hole. And he'll walk away bitter and at war. And Isaac will walk away and say, "Good riddance, get out of my land. And don't bother to tell me when you die. It's not worth the trip." And because this is the modeling that Isaac had for raising boys, watch where it goes. Verse 19. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramean from Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." And when the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. And the first came out was red. His whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Elmo. And after this, it's Esau in the Hebrew, and American word is Elmo. Same thing. It means red. And after this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up. Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Oh, and already the makings have started. These are our boys. It's from the same wife. But I saw how Dad did this. Dad loved one and sent the other out, and the favoritism starts. And it goes all the way back from the pregnancy. Rebecca's walking around, and she's heard about you can feel the baby move in the womb. But this is different. There's a head that kind of pokes out because it has a fist around its neck, pushing it out. And she's like, "That shouldn't be there." Then she feels one climb up to the top rope and jump off and land on the other one. And she's like, "What's going on?" And she's all, "This isn't the normal kicking. This isn't the, oh, feel how cute. There's punches being thrown." And she's all, "What's going on?" And God says, "They're already fighting. You got fighting boys. When Elmo is born, the other one's holding on to his heel. There's a battle to who comes out first. And when the first one comes out, he pulls the second one out. And from the very beginning, there's one that Dad loves and one that Mom loves. From the time he was about 4 or 5, little Esau, red, jumped up in the cab of the beat-up, dusty pickup truck and went off in the fields with Dad. Oh, he loved packing a little lunchbox just like Dad. He loved walking behind Dad in the business and the flocks and the herds. He loved sitting with Dad at the city gates. He loved taking off on his own. At the age of 6, coming back with the string with 4 lizards hanging on it. And Dad went down and said, "Boy, how'd you do that?" And a big smile across Elmo's face. "Got him with rocks, Dad. And he messed up his hair. That's my little man cub." Oh, by the time he was 10, he was shooting the bow and arrow like no one else. He could handle the spear. Now he would come back with deers laid across his shoulder. Dad had his picture up in his office. He lettered in 4 sports. This is Daddy's boy. Jacob learned how to cook. Jacob stayed home with Mom. Mom loved him. It's good to have a man around. It's good to have a man that's sensitive, that understands a woman's heart. It's good to have a man just to talk with, to do some of the harder work. It's good to have a son that takes note of the more artistic things in life. Now, one is not more masculine than the other. The problem with this passage is it was very clear. Dad loved one, Mom loved the other. Oh, parents, may I take a time out and just challenge you? Once you have more than one kid, there seems in most families to be a natural tendency to have a love for one more than the other. And I know as parents, you go, oh, I love them all equally. Yes, but there's still a tendency for favoritism. Maybe because one's more like you. They love the things that you like. They act like you. They think like you. They don't push your buttons as much. You're like, man, I really like spending time with this one. And the other one does that stuff. Maybe the one that's more like you is the one that you're like, I just can't be around this one. It's too much. Like you're just fighting all the time. Reminds you of your own sin. Maybe there's the one that's opposite, that grows up looking more like your spouse, and you're like, oh man, that's the one. It's just like little mom. Love her to death. If you ask my kids, I have favorites. I do. I'm open about that. You asked them last night. Someone asked them after the Saturday night service. They come down in front and run around, and they're all, Barrett, who's your dad's favorite? And he smiles and goes, me. I'm the boy. And I'm like, that's right. He's my favorite. And they turn to Karis, my second one. They go, Karis, who's dad's favorite? And she smiles. She goes, me. I'm his last girl. Stella, the oldest one, just smiles. She knows she's my favorite because she's the firstborn. And when you ask them who dad's favorite is, they're all going to say them, and they're all going to smile at each other. Oh, parents, let's make sure that we spend equal time, that we spend equal attention, that we pour into the lives of those that may even be a little different from us, that those that push our buttons more than the other, because kids will pick up at an early age. That's mama's boy. That's daddy's boy. And from an early age, it splits in the family. To the story when they're teenagers, we close chapter 25. Once when Jacob was cooking, when he was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. That's why he's also called Edom or Esau. It's red. And Jacob replied, first sell me your birthright. Now that boy's got a character issue. For some soup? Sell me the inheritance? Look, I'm about to die, Esau said. What good is the birthright to me? But Jacob said, no, you got to swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him, selling him the birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and got up and left. And then Esau despised his birthright. It's two teenagers. You see the scene. One's been hunting maybe a day, maybe 2 days. One's come in from the open field, from the country, from the hills, from the valleys, from a land afar. And he finally hits the screen door, walks into the house, and he is starving. And he tells his brother's standing there behind the stove with the apron on, just like mom's taught him, got a great big bowl of red stew. And he says, oh, I'm starving to death. I got to have some stew. Jacob's all, fine, give me your birthright. Now stop. Understand, in this day and age, then it meant that Esau, Red, was going to get 2/3 of the family estate. He was also going to get the family name passed on to him, the inheritance. And at the father's last dying days, he was going to get the blessing, the prophetic word from dad. This meant everything in that day and age. Everything. When you look at the land they have, the type of animals they have, and the coming stories that we'll even start numbering, this is probably a several million dollar deal. Be in exchange for soup. I don't care how good of a cook you are. You don't put that price tag on a bowl of soup. And I look at this and go, this kid's not starving to death. If you find Esau laying out under a tree because he can't move, because he's been weathered by the sun for a few days, he may be starving to death. When he opens the screen door and walks in and goes, I'm starving. You're not starving. You got some energy in you. All you have to do is tell mom, Mom, Jacob won't give me a bowl of soup. And you're like, Dad, give your brother a bowl of soup. Make a sandwich for Pete's sake. This is simply a teenager. You know how teenagers are. They got two gears, teenage boys. Starving or sleeping. That's what a teenager does. They're starving or sleeping. And they make the most irrational decisions, don't they? Oh, I remember growing up in a West Texas home with three teenage boys. Mom would fry up 4 chickens. She would do an entire bag of potatoes and mash them all together. Something to fill the gut. She'd put it on the table, and it would just be a trough. Just Mom had one rule. You got to wear a shirt. You got to wear a shirt. Growing up in West Texas, we're 10 months out of the year. You can die if you go outside. It's so hot. Mom said, look, I understand you walk around with shirts all day long. You got to wear a shirt at the dinner table. She goes, I don't want to see armpits over the food that I cooked. Now, most of us would just leave a shirt on the chair that we sat in. So we'd come in, slip into the shirt, sit down, slip out of the shirt, and go right back out. You could tell what you had like 4 nights in a row on your shirt. I learned early on, if you sat at the table and Mom put something on your plate and you're like, I don't like this, Dad, without saying a word, would reach over, take your plate, hand it to another brother, and everyone would keep eating. And you'd sit there and just stare. After a moment, Dad would look and he'd go, see you at breakfast. You're dismissed. You never complained about what was that. You ate it. You ate it before someone else ate it. This is just a teenage boy coming in starving. He's hungry. You can see the animosity, the hatred, the anger, the bitterness, the favoritism. One boy sees his opportunity to stick it to his brother. Some of your birthright. When are you stupid? That's worth a couple $1 million. I got red stew. Well, I'm starving. What do I care about my birthright? Fine. No, you got to swear to me. Fine, I swear to you. And he eats it. And then he gets up and he's like, well, that didn't count, did it? Yeah, that counted. Oh, and he despised his brother. Dad left a scar on the boys. Boy shows favoritism to son. Sons will scar each other. And even though there's so many directions we can go from this, I just want to take a time out today. I just want to end at Genesis 25. And I just want to ask you, who is it? For you, who is it? Who is it you're bitter at? Who is it that's hurt you? Who is it that's wronged you? Who is it that you feel like has ripped you off? Who is it that stabbed you in the back? Who is it that when the day for their memorial comes, you're going to say, good, the earth is a better place now? Who is it? For a lot of us, it may be a father figure that decades later, we're still carrying the pain from. For some of us, it was a spouse that said, till death do us part. And what they meant was, until my feelings change. Until I get tired of you or find something better. For some of us, it was a business partner that decided they can get a whole lot more without us. Who is it? Because I want to leave the book of Genesis, something we haven't done much in this series. We've been going verse by verse. I want to take you to one passage. And I want to challenge you to do something with that person. Like I said at the beginning, it may be one of the hardest things I've ever challenged you to do. And if you're sitting here today and you go, you know what? I don't have a beef against anybody or no one has it against me. There's no one in the world I'm bitter or angry at. Great. Welcome to maybe 5% of us. Take notes because the day will happen. All of us will be hurt and wronged in this life. And if we're not told what to do with it, we're going to be the ones that carry the burden on it. We're going to be the ones that carry the pain of it. And I want to take you to one more book. From the beginning of the Bible, we're going all the way to the back toward the end. It's a book called Matthew. Back in the New Testament, since you're already in Genesis, if you don't know where Matthew is, just go to the very front page. It'll tell you what page number it is. If you like to flip it and find it, go all the way to the back. Look for the guys' names. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're all pretty big books. And I want you to go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. In Matthew 18, there's almost an entire chapter devoted to a theme Jesus has been teaching. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus looked at the crowd and said, guys, here's something I want to tell you. It's going to be tough. If you're coming to the temple to do sacrifices, and there you remember somebody's got some anger and bitterness towards you, leave your sacrifice first. Go clear that up and then come back. And the crowd's astonished to realize the temple in Jerusalem. For a lot of Jews, it was a 2 or 3 day journey to come there and offer a sacrifice. And Jesus goes, I know, it's been a long journey. I want you to take the 2 day walk back. I want you to clear up that anger and bitterness and then walk back 2 days. It's a 4 day round trip. But don't come to church if you're holding on to that type of bitterness or if there's bitterness against you. Can you imagine if we applied that? Before all of our weekend venues and services, we had you fill out a card. Are you bitter at anyone? Or is anyone bitter at you? Sorry, you can't come. We'd be down to one venue, a very small venue. He picked up the very next chapter in Matthew 6 when they said, teach us how to pray. And he had the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we have forgot our debtors. Or forgive us our trespasses as we have forgiven those who trespassed against us, regardless of how you learned it. Jesus says, you know what your prayer should be? God, forgive me the way I've forgiven those that have really hurt me. That's the one prayer Jesus gave us as a model. He says, when it comes to forgiveness, ask God to forgive you the way you've forgiven those that hurt you. And then he gets to Matthew 18. Verse 15. If your brother has sinned against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. But if he will not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or tax collector. See, I tell you the truth. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I tell you, if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there I am with them. Jesus goes, look, let me tell you, if you've got a brother, and that's not a natural born brother, it's another Christian. If you've got someone in the family of God that you've got something against, that there's wrong between you, I tell you, work it out. And if you can't work it out, take some people with you. Not with pitchforks and flames. Not to burn a brother, but to win someone back. Say, look, we can't get to an agreement on this. Can we get some wise people, some referees around us, some mediators to help? And if that person is so obstinate, they still want nothing to do with you and won't admit it, and you can't admit it, he goes, then have nothing to do with them. You got to walk away. See, in the Christian life, if someone has hurt and wronged you, there's only two options we have. Deal with it or drop it. It's the only two options we have. Gossiping about it is not obedience. Carrying on bitterness is not obedience. Holding a grudge is not obedience. He said, you either deal with it or you got to drop it. And if you come together and say, we're done with it, we drop it, God says, I'm good with that. I'm blessing that. And you go, whoa. Are you telling me my forgiveness has something to do with me not forgiving dad? A spouse? A parent? A child? A brother? A sister? You don't understand the divorce we're in. You don't understand what they've done. Oh, the cards I already got from Saturday evening services. Chris, what about the guy that raped my daughter and took her virginity? And that's exactly what I'm talking about today. Some more incredible men and women that came back and said, what about the guy that killed four of my Marines in front of me? Whew. That's exactly what I'm talking about today. Some of you have had some of the most horrific acts done to your life. You're an innocent victim in this. What do you do with it? And Jesus goes, look, this is going to be hard, so let me tell you a story. And I love it when Jesus goes the story. Verse 21. So Peter came to Jesus, and he asked, Lord, well then how many times do I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Up to seven? And he's being really holy on this. The rabbis had a debate in the first century. How many times do you forgive someone? And they decided the number was three. Someone hurts you, forgive him, hurts you, forgive him, hurts you, forgive him, fourth time, out of luck. Three. So Peter takes three, doubles it, plus one. Seven? Should I forgive him up to seven? That's ludicrous. Jesus goes, here's what's ludicrous. I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times. Or some verses say seven times 70. It doesn't matter. Jesus doesn't say keep counting. He goes, no, it's endless. It's endless forgiveness. Stupid. Because let me tell you a story why. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And as he began to settle them, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. And the servant fell on his knees before him. Just be patient with me, he begged. I'm going to pay back everything. And the servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. The crowd at this time is giggling, by the way. It's the humorous side of Jesus that sometimes we miss out on. Jesus goes, let me tell you a story. There's a king who demands that all of his servants would be faithful to him. When he looked at who owed him what, one guy owed him a gazillion dollars. A gazillion. It's a fictional number that just means more than anything you can think of. And that's exactly the price here. Commentators have argued this is between probably $12 million and $1 billion in that day and age. No. The understanding is it's a ridiculous amount. And the king goes, one of you owe me a gazillion dollars. And the crowd's like, what? And the guy falls on his knees and goes, I'm going to pay it back. And the crowd laughs. You can't pay back a gazillion dollars. We're all in poverty here. And the king forgives him a gazillion dollars, even though his life and his family should have been sold by it and he would have been put in prison. And the crowd's like, this is one of the craziest stories ever. Jesus goes, wait, it's about to get crazy. 28. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. That's 100 days' wage. And he grabbed him and he began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. And his fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I'll pay you back. It's word for word what he told the king. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. And when the servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and they went and told their master everything that happened. And the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? And in his anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you. Unless you forgive your brother from your heart. What? He said, it's your unforgiveness of others that's torturing you. It's your refusing to let go that's torturing you. And let me tell you why that person in your life I ask you to think about needs to be forgiven. And Jesus said, it's because of how you've been forgiven. He says, now let me tell you, church, let me tell you, this has very little to do with them and everything to do with you, your heart, your future, and your walk with God. And Jesus gets that. He understands that. He's the maker of us, our heart. He understands us better than anyone. And it's Jesus laying down, I want you to let this go. I started thinking about this week. What if Jesus was serious? What if this is actually what he's saying? And I tried to get a picture of this. And I thought, you know what it's like. In a very real way, this is exactly what Jesus is trying to teach and what he's trying to do. He says, you know what? Each one of us have people in our life. And each one of us have a jar with their name on it. These are the people we come in contact with. And he says, unfortunately, here's exactly what's happened to some of you. He says, some of you have gotten to a place and a time where you got some people in your life that have come in and they've hurt you in some incredible ways. You got some people in your life that have come in and just jacked you up with some sin issues, haven't you? And some people that came into your life, the stuff we use on black widows and ants. And he says, you've got some people in your life that have come in and they've just sprayed poison into your life. Unfortunately, some of these people were supposed to be in positions to love you and care for you. And they're the ones that have just injected you. And you're walking around with this poured into your system. And he says, church, here's what I want to get after today. What do you do with this? Because now you're walking around with this. Now you're walking around with this poison that's meant to kill. It's what they did to you. It's that act that was done. It's the way he left you, even though he was supposed to bring you into the Word. The way your mom has turned your back on it. It's this in your life. And you're walking around going, what do I do with this? And he said, here's the problem. Every time we come across this person, every time we have a memory and that poison's there, he goes, we just keep soaking it in. We just walk around going, man, it's this person in my life. If this wouldn't happen, would you? Because the way this person's hurt me, and my life would be so much different. And Ishmael shows up and said, you know the life I should have had if it wasn't for Dad. And what are you doing with my life? And we drink this poison in, thinking it's hurting them, but it's just killing us. And we walk around, and the problem is the glass never empties. The problem is we're always going to have this issue. this situation, this person. And it is 60 years later, and Ishmael comes back, and he still can't deal with the brother. And they will be at war with each other. Because every time they come back to their family issue, they just take another guzzle. And we're holding on to it. And it is killing you. It is robbing you of your inheritance. It's robbing you of the joy you're supposed to have. It's taking you from the life that you're supposed to be living. And Jesus shows up and he goes, let me tell you how to knock it off. Knock it off. It's killing you. And I talk to people that are 10, 20, 40, 60 years removed. And they haven't been able to stop sipping the poison that's been sprayed in their life. You know, Chris, you don't understand. You don't understand how wrong that is. You don't understand how bad that was. You don't understand. And I'm like, look, I get it. I might not understand your situation, but I get it. It was horrific. It was heinous. It was pure sin. But you're the one paying the price. Sipping the poison. And I want to leave you with how to work this out. Great message. Now what? How to stop sipping the poison. I want to give you a few quick things as you walk out the door. So you go, here's what I got to do with this person in my life. And number one is simply this. Forgive like we have been forgiven. We got to forgive like we have been forgiven. It's the point of the story. It's the only way this makes sense. Jesus says, you forgive them because of the way the King, your God, has forgiven you. You wronged God. You don't deserve it. You can't live it out. You can't work for it. You've wronged God. And God forgave you. But you don't know what they did. Jesus said, no. Look how the King has forgiven you. What Jesus did on the cross, he says, now pass that on. I can't possibly say what they did was right. We're not saying it was right. We're not condoning it. We're not saying it was okay. What he's saying is, you've got to cap this. This person, this situation will always be in your life. But you got to cap this. When you look at it, you're going to claim that was poison. That was wrong. But it's not in my life anymore. I can handle this. It's not getting into who I am and what I'm created to be. He says, I need you to put a lid on this. I need you to let it go. And the only way we can do that is understand the way God has forgiven me. And I know you stop and go, but they don't deserve it. Neither do we. I do not deserve the cross. I can never deserve God's grace and mercy. And he says, if you've been forgiven by me, you pass it on. You pass it on. I can't forget about this, Chris. Number two, forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting. Forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting about it. We have this ludicrous idea because the way we take some scriptures out of context that God has forgotten all of our sins. That's ludicrous. If God has forgotten all of my sins, he only knows about 2 weeks of my life combined. He doesn't even know me. God hasn't forgotten my sins. God doesn't hold them against me anymore. God looks at me and says, no, my son capped that. Done. Forgiven. Oh, I know who Chris is. I know what he's done. That doesn't stand in the way anymore. That's been paid for. I'm not saying you can ever forget about that individual, that moment, that time, or what they've done to you. It will always be there. What I'm saying is you keep that from bittering, poisoning the rest of your life. Underneath that I put be nice, not naive. You don't invite this back in. You don't give this another opportunity to give you a shot of poison. I mean, I had to go through this with some of the most horrific child abuse, sexual molestation in our family. That an uncle and a brother should never have to walk through with the family. Oh, I tell you, the hatred, the bitterness I had towards the guy that poisoned our family. I wanted to kill him. We were about 5 states away. Otherwise, I would have taken a shot at it. Literally, a shot at it. That's the problem with West Texas. But I tell you, it was just killing me. It was just killing me. Now I see that person. I understand who they are and what they're still filled with and the poison that they are. I tell you what, they're not invited around my family. They're not ever to spend time with my kids. But when I'm around them, I can deal with them. When I'm around them, I can be nice. I'm not forgetting that it happened. You're not forgetting that something took place. You're learning how to deal with it in a way that doesn't take your future. It no longer has a toll on you. The irony is, when we hold on to the bitterness and the anger, it doesn't affect that person. In fact, for some of you, that person may take some delight that it's still hurting you. That ex may still take some delight that it's still bugging you. And Jesus says, you can't live like that. You can't go on with that. Don't be naive. It doesn't mean you have to invite him back. It doesn't mean you're going to be best friends. It just means, okay, I've learned how to deal with that. How do you treat them? I've gone to number three. Love is a choice, not an emotion. We choose to be nice to them. We choose to show them love. It doesn't mean we're in love with them. Jesus never said you had to like them. He said you got to love them. Love's a choice, not a feeling. There are people in my life that have hurt me or my family in ways I will never like them. That's quite okay with the Word of God. He says, but you show them love. You choose to respond to them in a loving way. I no longer hate them. I feel sorry for them. What kind of jar has that kind of poison in it? What kind of person throws their life away? What kind of man does that? I feel sorry for him. I'll pray for him. I don't have to like him. But I'll show him love if I ever answer the phone. If we're ever around a family gathering and it comes back together, I'll show him love. I feel sorry for who they are and how they grew up, that that's the way they decided to handle people in their life. But Chris, you don't understand. This person deserves to be hurt. Yes, I agree. And that's why number four, let God bring justice, not us. I love this Romans 12. It's in your note sheet. You might want to circle it right under stop sipping the poison. It says, do not repay anyone evil for evil, evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's holy wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay them, says the Lord. I love that verse. I look at the people that have hurt me or others in life and I just go, sick 'em, God. And God's word says, Chris, if you have revenge, you will probably end up going to prison. And I'm like, I know. And God goes, let me deal with them, boy. Let me deal with them in this life and beyond in a way you can't touch. And oh, that warms my heart. Let me tell you, some of the most righteous prayers in the Bible are from David, who prays for his enemies to be slain, for their children to be beggarless, homeless, and to go about blind and destitute. And God goes, oh, that's a good one. Print it. Thanks for letting me know how you want it handled. Let me take care of it. And David goes, yours. Sick him. Sick him. Because I'm tired of sipping the poison. I'm tired of walking around holding this. And you let go and let God and say, God, you bring justice, not me. And in the end, we can only do what we can do. We can only do what we can do. God says, as far as it depends on you, if possible, live at peace with everyone. And if not, let him go. Some of you just need to say, I've got to let this go. I may never see him again. You may not even know exactly who they are. Some of you say, you know what, that funeral's already come and gone. I live with the regrets. You've got to love it go. Some of you, though, still have time to write a note, to drop an email, to pick up the phone, to do a visit and go, you know what, it's been a long time. I'm here simply to say I forgive you. I feel like you've hurt me in some huge ways. I forgive you. Even though they didn't ask for it. For your own benefit, not theirs. And if they slam the door and laugh, you walk away and say, God, that one's on you. Sick them. Sick them. But I'm capping this one. I told you I'm going to ask you to do one of the hardest things I've ever asked you to do as a church. But this is killing you, not them. And we were not made to walk around with bitterness, unresolved anger, hatred because of what's been done to us. There is sin and poison in people's lives, and I'm sorry it's affected us in some amazing ways. And Jesus says, deal with it. Oh, understand the way I forgave you. Understand the love I had for you. Romans 5:8, that God demonstrated or showed His love for us, that while we were still sinning against Him, Christ died for us. And because of that, and only that, you forgive also. It's not saying it's right. It's not saying they deserve it. They deserve justice. God said, I'll deal with that. But it's killing you. Let it go. And as far as I read the Lord's Prayer and the teachings of Jesus, it seems like our forgiveness hinges on that. Not that unforgiveness is unforgivable by God, but He's saying, if you can't forgive, then maybe your heart has never truly understood the forgiveness of God. And that's where we may be in danger. It's for you. It's your benefit. And Jesus says, let me take it. Oh, let me deal with it. But let it go. God, may we be a people now that have your spirit, your strength to actually do something with this. May we be a people now, God, that can walk out of here today and say, God, here they are, and all that's done and all that's happened. If possible, God, may we reconcile and both of us come together. If we can't reconcile, may we at least forgive. Even if they don't ask for it and deserve it, that's the point. May we allow you to take it and to bring your justice. Because God, it is eating us up. God, I thank you for the cross and the way you have forgiven us. May we understand that depth, that passion, that love, and may we be able to pass it on. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online. www.northcoastchurch.com, or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
As you go, I know this message probably frustrated some of you. And if it did, this last statement's going to tear you up. I get that. We say it all the time around here. Christianity is not a title because of a religion or a church you go to. Christianity means I am like Christ. That's who I follow. And if you are a Christian, when He found those that sinned and hurt Him, He went to every measure to forgive. You want to be a Christian in your relationship, you find who's hurt you the most, and you go to every measure to forgive. That's when it becomes being like Christ, not a religion. Only because how He forgave us. It's an incredibly tough homework assignment. Pray you live it out this next week. We'll pick it up from there next week. Turn around, greet another jar or something. See you next week.